Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Scrum Down NBC Sports Rugby Podcast. I am your host with the most, Alex Corbusier, and it is great to be back, everyone. Lots to talk about in the rugby world. It's been a busy weekend of news. The big one has been Eddie Jones has been hired as Australia coach. Dave Rennie is out. Eddie Jones seeing that contract through to the 2027 World Cup, home World Cup in Australia. There's a Lions series in 25. It's incredible turnaround there as well. He'll see them at this World Cup where he could meet England in the quarterfinals. Makes the RFU look like they have a bit of egg on their face after releasing him. Lots to talk about. Should have there been a non-compete clause? Should have been on gardening leave? What does this mean for Australia? As well as that, there's also been Steve Borthwick announcing his first squad as head coach in England. And to react to the Eddie Jones news and that, we have Chris Jones on from the BBC. He was at Twickenham today speaking to Sinfield and Borthwick. He's been talking all about the Eddie Jones stuff for the BBC. Great insight. Lots to talk about. Also get on to the Owen Farrell as captaincy, red card debate. Should he have played? Should he not? Lots to break down in this week's episode. It is a long one, so let's get straight into it. And here to talk all the latest news, good friend of the pod, Chris Jones from the BBC. Chris, it's been an interesting 24 hours in the rugby world. I'm sure, you know, you've talked about it a lot, but amazing news with this Eddie Jones turnaround. The story just keeps getting better and better.
Unbelievable. I was in bed Sunday night, UK time, about to drop off to sleep. Suddenly the phone buzzed. Eddie Jones, Australia coach, not Australia coach after the 2023 World Cup. That was what I think we all expected. I was pretty confident Eddie Jones was going to be coaching Australia against the Lions in 2025. I just didn't see him coming in now, you know, because they had a head coach in Dave Rennie. So for Eddie Jones to go to this 2023 World Cup, if he didn't want to go as a consultant or as an assistant coach, someone would have to get sacked. Rennie's been sacked. Jones is in. It feels kind of like a use it or lose it kind of thing. Rugby Australia maybe wanted Jones lined up down the line. Jones had other offers. And here he is, Australia coach, as of the next couple of weeks for this World Cup. Lions Tour 2027. Could meet England in the quarterfinals. You couldn't write it, could you? It's a genuinely fantastic story.
It's incredible. And I think it just spurns on from the saga. And it just adds fuel to the fire for those that were saying, why are we letting Eddie go? Why have we, after this long? And it kind of puts the RFU in an interesting position, because you'd look at it from the outside in. The initial plan was going to be keep Eddie in charge. Steve Borthwick would join that in the summer, and you'd have a brains trust of Borthwick, Eddie, and a transition to the next one. Results, fan, you know, decisions, media turning, all kind of led to this, all right, we can't go with Eddie anymore. And now England in a position where I think the most successful England coach from a winning perspective, and I think other than Steve Hansen, probably has one of the best records at the Rugby World Cup as a coach, are now in a different team's camp that you might meet in a quarterfinal. You're all of a sudden got a bit egg on your face, you know, with the headlines and sort of the media storm coming around.
Yeah, it's a kind of a nightmare situation for the RFU, because the last thing they would want is to have Eddie Jones come back to haunt them come the World Cup. Look, I don't know if this necessarily means that the decision was wrong to move on from Eddie Jones. You know, I'm hearing enough stuff coming out of the England camp to suggest that that team had lost its way. And when a team has lost its way, how easy is it to come back? You'd know better than me, Corbs. Like, is that easy then just to click your fingers, have a couple of months off for Christmas, go again? Maybe in World Cup year with Eddie Jones's World Cup experience, the way he would have worked them in the training camp, it could have happened. However, I don't think necessarily when fans are booing at Twickenham, you're getting panned by an understrength South Africa. I don't know that necessarily, just because Jones has resurfaced, means the decision to move him on was wrong. It doesn't mean he's not a good coach. Australia have said he's the best in the world. They've moved heaven and earth to get him. It's just a fascinating story for like us guys who watch this game, love this game, and want there to be noise and narratives and a bit of controversy, a bit of bites, a bit of, you know, just this rugby having a profile. it's got all of that, hasn't it? And we'll see whether, you know, Borthwick and Eddie are on a kind of collision course, whether Borthwick will take on his coaching mentor. We know Gatland's Wales going to face Eddie Jones's Australia. And I think from a Lions point of view, you know, Australia Lions are special to you, I know, but that 2025 Lions tour wasn't filling me with a load of excitement compared to maybe a South Africa or a New Zealand. Now with Eddie Jones at the helm, whole new complexion. So overnight, again, the international rugby landscape has changed, and we've said that a lot over the past month, where we've had three regime changes for three major nations.
I agree, mate. I think where, for me, where it makes the decision not look stupid, because I do feel there was a strong argument that they had to enact change with the direction of the team, is more just like how they silly it looks to back it for as long as they did. Eddie's our guy all the way to the World Cup, and then pull the U-turn. And then this is now kind of what makes the decision look a bit weird, is that it was just very of it. It's a reactionary decision. It wasn't strategically thought out. And then I think maybe from an RFU point of view, some loose ends potentially left untied, with no sort of non-compete clause, no sort of gardening leave. I don't know the full implications of that contract, but I've just been going by social media and Twitter. I thought I would ask you, like, what were the RFU's options in that situation with potentially preventing this, or, you know, having some control of how Eddie's coaching journey could continue in the short term?
Really interesting one, isn't it? Because that's the obvious question. Are the RFU, in effect, paying Eddie Jones now to coach against them? Surely not. You know, that's mad to think, isn't it? But they obviously would have had a severance deal with Eddie. I wonder whether there was a term that said, look, we'll pay you out, but if you get a new job, then we're quits. I checked with the RFU what the deal was, and they said, when the RFU ended Eddie's role as England head coach, having considered both the legal and moral perspectives, it was decided it would be unreasonable to restrict Eddie in seeking alternative employment. That kind of confuses me, because the legal and moral, as we could discuss with the Owen Farrell ban in a moment, they're completely contradictory. If it's a legal reason, then the RFU could just go, legally, Eddie was being paid out till 2023, therefore he's on gardening leave. He can't work for anyone else. If it's a moral thing, you think that's quite a nice gesture from the RFU to a guy who's given 7 years of service. But the fact they say it's sort of legal and moral, if it was just legal, they don't need to be moral. And if it's moral, why reference the legal side? Because if it's moral as a moral gesture, the legalities don't come into it. And if it's a legal gesture or a legal issue, the morality doesn't. Anyway, that's the statement. That's the reality.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, Eddie can do what he wants. And he has, and he is, and he's coaching Australia now.
It's amazing. And I think just for clarity, like, is it a financial issue? Like, would they, to keep him on gardening leave, would it make them cost them any more money? Was it literally just a decision that they were okay with a potential outcome like this happening? Like, what were the contributing factors for them choosing the route they choose? I know they said legal and moral, but would it have cost them more money to keep Eddie off the World Cup radar as a head coach?
I genuinely am speculating here. So I it's a simple answer, I don't know. You would expect that to keep him under wraps for a year would cost them more. They were about to get Steve Borthwick out of Leicester, Kevin Sinfield out of Leicester, Nick Evans out of Harlequins. I know he's doing a kind of job share. So this is an RFU post-pandemic who aren't flush with cash. Maybe they've taken the option that is more financially viable. And yeah, look, Eddie at 62, 63, he's not got a million more opportunities to coach at the World Cup. You know, I don't think he would want to coach much past 70. Maybe he would, but not many coaches do they? You know, like someone like Steve Hansen's a few years older. You know, he feels like he's done with frontline coaching, same for like Ian McGeachan. So the coaches don't go on forever. They retire at some point. So maybe there was a nice gesture from the RFU, or maybe, and the England fans will really hope this isn't the case. They've been a bit careless and they've thought, well, who's he going to coach? He might go and coach the States, who aren't at the World Cup.
Yeah.
Might go and coach, well, they wouldn't coach Japan because Jamie Joseph's in situ. Dave Rennie's in Australia. You know, Ian Foster's in the All Blacks, who don't go overseas. Springboks don't go overseas for a head coach, nor do France. So maybe they just didn't think there was much of an option for Eddie. But he's got the one that could hurt them the most. And the one I think that means the most to Eddie Jones. However much you enjoyed his regime or didn't enjoy his regime with England, you still never felt he was completely and utterly immersed in the culture in the UK. I don't think he's going to have stayed around, even if he didn't have another job to go to. It always felt like he never massively embraced England as a place. And I might be wrong, but Australia's his home. This is a huge job for him. And if it's his last big job, what a last big job. And it just lends such a layer of excitement and intrigue to the whole year.
Yeah, I just don't think you could script it better for him. Like, after what's happened to him this autumn, like, the ultimate shot at redemption that he gets to take, you know, the team that's probably the closest to his heart, a team where he, you know, is speaking publicly about mistakes he's made, the missed opportunities he had to win a World Cup, for all these aspects, he now gets to take that team to a World Cup to show sort of the, stick the finger up as such to the RFU, whoever the doubters that, you know, that threw shade at him or whatever. He has this opportunity to sort of go this Cinderella story, but then he also has an opportunity for a World Cup on home soil for Australia, where it must haunt him for however many years that he's in that driving seat now at home to rewrite history and rewrite maybe something that hasn't gone his way. Like, I just think it couldn't be much better. And then you look at the story from another lens and you're like, well, it's actually pretty cool. Like, England, we're all quite excited. We've got Steve Borthwick. First time in 7 years England have been coached by a homegrown coach or an English coach again. There's a lot of excitement, all this stuff going on. And then you flip that to Australia, who there's been a lot of frustration at times with Rennie, a bit of up and down with results, and they've suffered from injuries at times, and there's been mitigating factors, but there's also been some things to be unhappy with, but there's been positive bright sparks, and it's an incredible squad they have when everyone's fit as well. And now they get their homegrown coach as well to sort of rejuvenate and bring pride and everything back to the jersey. It's kind of an interesting story just from that outlook as well, I find.
100%. And look, it's been said a lot over the last few years. World rugby needs a strong Australia. Look, it needs a strong everyone. It needs a strong America, strong South Africa, England, Wales, whatever. But given Australia's location, given how much they play against New Zealand, given if they're not competitive, the rugby championship therefore isn't competitive. They need a strong Australia for Super Rugby's sake, for the whole of rugby in that part of the world, for the Lions in 25, for the Men's World Cup in 27, for the Women's World Cup after that. And the fact that he's taking on the Wallaroos as well, he's overlooking the women's team, which is another fascinating angle. He's got the keys to the whole rugby country, basically.
I know.
He's got the keys to Rugby Australia. They've just got do your best or do your worst. But if Australia are weak or inconsistent, middling, they've been frustratingly average for ages now. When was the last real vintage Australia side? Had a cracking World Cup in 2015, didn't they?
That's it. I'd say that's it.
I'm scratching my head.
World Cup resurgent. Yeah.
2015 World Cup, like the 2011 team got to the semis, but lucky against the Springboks in the quarters. The Springboks were a better side. And then we're going back like, 07, no, knocked out by England in the quarters. Not a great England side. 03, pretty decent side, got to the final. 01, they were a great side. 01, 99, great, great side. But they've not reached those heights in 20 years plus. If Eddie can do it, it's going to be huge for the global game. And you look just not at the here and now, but at the Lions in 25 and the World Cups coming up towards the end of the decade.
Yeah, it's quite an exciting dynamic because rugby union in Australia always struggles a little bit to compete for, you know, the news, the public attention. You've got rugby league, Aussie rules, all different aspects it has to compete with. You compound that with, like we've just talked about, a lack of success over recent years. This story of Eddie in charge, potentially to turn it around short term in a World Cup, but then to get a public inspired. Imagine if they win the Lions series, then turn into a home World Cup. World Rugby, I think, and everyone been really hoping that this Australia World Cup is going to be a financial success. And I think this is kind of fuel to that fire that gives it a chance to really sort of ignite a nation in the run into that home World Cup for them.
Yeah, and the thing is, there's no guarantee Eddie's going to be a success, is there? Like, he did some great things at England at the start, but he inherited a pretty settled side or a team with, you know, Vunipola's Farrell, Ford, Ben Youngs, Courtney, Maratoge coming through, Jamie George coming through, Dylan Hartley around, Haskell Brown, Rob Shaw. You couldn't quite roll off the tongue those players from an Australian perspective. You know, they've got guys like Tupou, Class, Rob Valentini, Karevi will be back on the scene. I'm not sure where, how long Michael Hooper's got left at international rugby. So there's some players there, but I don't think it's a vintage player pool. And they're probably reliant on a few guys, maybe Will Skelton coming back to Australia. I'm not so sure, but there's no guarantee he's going to go well. What there is a guarantee is he's going to bring noise and profile and some buzz around Australian rugby union, which is desperately needed.
On paper, that Australian squad, when it's fully fit, is pretty deep. But that back line has got so many different threats and you've got different opportunities there. I think this is like Eddie all over again. Like you saw in a short period of time, he took a 2015 crash and burn World Cup exit into a Grand Slam in a matter of months. He's got more runway than that to turn around for this World Cup. Like that's kind of his MO, is to come into a machine that's already operating at least some level, usually at a subpar level, which is why Eddie's been called in. And he kind of finds a way to gauge that last maybe 10, 15% that was missing in the puzzle. Where he struggled has been the recycle. You know, post-2003 with Australia, struggled. Now, after England, with that second go at a World Cup, struggled on the rebuild. If anything, the issue for me for Australia would be making sure the right sort of parameters are in place for that 4-year cycle to the World Cup, where I don't actually have too much worry about Eddie and that immediate run to the World Cup, because I think that's like Eddie Jones in a nutshell. Like I think that's where they're going to get the biggest boom, is going to be in the first couple months when you get that Eddie attention to detail and his eyes on a machine that was working a different way and how he can rejig it to be a bit more successful.
And that brings me on to another point. I'm not surprised that Gatland and Eddie have both got 5-year deals, but I'd be surprised if they both fulfill those 5 years.
Yeah.
And like Borthwick may be different. He's not that sort of same coaching experience as those two, but those two seem to have come back to, I say, their homelands. Gatland's not Welsh, but he kind of he'd be an adopted Welsh citizen by now easily. And they've kind of gone to the union and just been able to name their price, haven't they? You feel that if they said, oh, name the stadium after me, the union would have gone, yeah, okay. Well, the Eddie Jones Telstra Dome or the Warren Gatland Principality Stadium or just the Warren Gatland. We're living in this age of the super coach that kind of walks on water, that seem to have more power than the unions. And I don't think that's quite the right way of going about it. I think, if anything, this last month should have taught us that 4 years, it's a long time in rugby union. A lot can change. And I know that that coaches want that job security, but I'd have been tempted, if possible, if I was Wales, England or Australia, to give them 2 to 3 year deals and see where things are halfway through the cycle. Because ultimately, this last few weeks, months has taught us a cycle, it doesn't mean anything. It's a myth. It's a made up fabrication. When in reality, fans kind of want success wherever it is in the cycle. If you get beaten badly in a Six Nations game, people don't want to shrug their shoulders and go, oh, it's okay, it's the wrong time of the World Cup cycle. So I think we need to move away from this World Cup obsession and go. And actually, the fact that you're talking about Australia being a success, I'm talking potentially about England being a success, Wales fans might think Wales can be a success, all having changed coach 9 months for a World Cup, surely that puts up in smoke this idea that coaches need 4 years of careful planning to get it right. Because after 3 years, three of these coaches have got sacked in the cycle.
Well, that's the thing. I think it's one of these things where it seems to be these guys are like, when the union have realized that they may have made a mistake or they're in trouble and they backed the wrong horse or the wrong plan over a cycle, all of a sudden there's the bat sign in the sky. And that's when you're Eddie Jones or you're Warren Gatlin or now Steve Borthwick, the sort of white knight characters, ride into town to try and save the day. And it really, when you are in the charge of these unions and the ones who make the decisions and maybe appoint someone or back someone that now it seems more likely it's the wrong horse. It's the ultimate eraser. Like, hey, don't look at what we've been doing over here. Look at what we've just brought in and how we're going to fix
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
You know, and it kind of hides some of the issues that maybe were underlying of why they're in that position in the first place.
Yeah, no, completely. And yeah, I just think it's really, really exciting. But even though Rugby Australia, RFU, WRU will all feel pretty smug about life because they've got in a coach in Gatland's and Eddie's case with load of experience and load of goodwill amongst their fan base. And in Borthwick's case, an amazing coach and someone who is making all the right noises and has got an incredible future in coaching and feels like it is sort of his destiny to coach his country. So all the unions are pretty happy with life. But they've had to sack someone 3 years into a cycle and got it completely against their business plan, which was all about a World Cup. So it's funny. Funny, isn't it?
It's comical that they're not even talking about the World Cup after that was literally the only argument when any criticism was thrown over what was going over under the Eddie administration. Like it is kind of comical. I think the other thing to keep an eye on in this story as well is like a lot of what we talked about with his undoing in England. To me, like, I still think you could have continued with Eddie. I think the biggest issue he had was the staff turnover. Like, I know I've said that a million times, but I honestly feel like that was his undoing. And now I'm like, what's it going to look like with his staff in Australia? Like, who's he going to bring in? Is he going to put together like a super crew? Is he going to keep the same staff? How does that look like? And how is he able to keep his staff together for this next 5 years or whatever till the next World Cup? And does he learn from some of the issues he's had here with England?
And remember, Scott Weismantle randomly left Australia a couple of weeks ago.
So I know, I was just about to ask you that. And they know each other and have a relationship from 2019.
They did. But Weismantle only came in the summer of 18. And then went to 19. So he didn't have long. He was best part of 18 months, maybe not even that. And I don't know, it just looks, if you put two and two together, you think, well, Weismantle gets wind Eddie's coming in and goes, I don't know if I've got another bit of time with Eddie in me. I've done my Eddie shift. It was tough.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go and do something else. So yeah. Has that Eddie Jones going through assistance started already? It feels too much of a coincidence for Weismantle. And again, we're speculating a bit on the pod, which we shouldn't. But it feels a little bit too convenient that Weismantle has gone out of the blue when he was doing a decent enough job.
Got flashbacks at 5 a.m. meetings. He's like 5 a.m. starts every day.
Well, someone's gone to him. There's going to be a change here. Or I don't know, or maybe they've gone, look, we need to make a few changes. Or Eddie's gone, look, I want to bring in my own guy. Who knows? But it's just...
Yeah,
it's just noticeable that not just Rennie's gone, but Weismantle, who's the attack coach, has gone as well.
No, it's fascinating. Like, it is fascinating. And I think it's fascinating who is he going to bring in or what changes in that sort of setup in the run-in now to this World Cup. And I think it's a lot. I think that's Eddie Jones sort of wrapped up and bundled. The other bit of news I want to talk about is we got our first Steve Borthwick England squad on paper. You were at Twickenham today, speaking to him in Sinfield. What did you make of, first of all, Sinfield and Borthwick today? And then we'll get into the actual team they picked.
Well, I think what's really noticeable is that this is, it's the Steve Borthwick regime, but it's also the Steve Borthwick and Kevin Sinfield regime. Sinfield's his right-hand man. And actually, if he hadn't been busy with another commitment when Borthwick was unveiled, Sinfield would have been sitting next to him on the top table when Borthwick was announced as England head coach on whatever it was, the 19th of December. So these two are a pair. That was struck me about today. Every time normally there's a squad announcement over the last 7 years, it's been Eddie and Eddie only. This time it's Kevin Sinfield and Steve Borthwick. So they're a pair, they're a team. And that's really shone through over the last few weeks. Look, they make all the right noises. They come across incredibly authentic. I think it's a shame that Borthwick's had to get caught up in the RFU gaming the system over Farrell's ban, which is a bit of a shame because Steve Borthwick is incredibly honest and a man full of integrity. So the fact he's got caught up in this is a bit disappointing. But no, they're authentic, they're genuine. And as much, Corbs, as we can discuss the personnel, Dan Cole back in, love to get your take on that. Ben Earl back in, Elliot Daly back in, out goes May Knoll and Billy Vitapola. For me, it's not really about personnel. It's about a change in mindset. It's about tactical clarity. It's about reconnecting with the fans. It's about changing the whole feel around English rugby. Borthwick has inherited a good squad of players. He's been at pains to point out that the players aren't the problem necessarily. It was just things over tactical clarity, mindset, preparation that maybe was lacking over the last 6 months. And that, I think, is where you'll see the major changes, but maybe not on the team sheet, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I too probably expected potentially a bit more overhaul or change. Like, it is a lot of continuity in a lot of areas. Some big names like Billy Vinopola not in the mix. Dom Brandt back in, which I can see potentially on form, or, you know, especially bringing Nick Evans in as a tack coach, potentially having a bit more Quinn-centric players in there as well could make sense. And I think for me, what I'm curious is this team is reasonably similar to what we've seen with England. How are they going to play? Like, how different is it going to be from what we saw in the autumn? Or, you know, where do you think the style of rugby goes with Nick Evans doing the attack, Sinfield doing defence, Borthwick back in charge? I'm very curious of how we're going to see them play and how exactly they line up, especially in a backline point of view, where it looks like the consensus is Farrell at 10, with the captaincy being handed to him as well.
Massive call. And a lot of people today were like, oh, of course Farrell's captain. For me, it was never that obvious. Farrell's been captain 5 years. You're having a regime change. Sometimes the captain changes with it. And I think there is still this uncertainty over the playmaking axis. Is it Marcus Smith's shirt at 10? Is it Farrell? Is it both? Was that the kind of 2022 experiment that didn't really work, Smith and Farrell alongside each other? Or did they just get rubbish ball? And the scrum was going backwards. They weren't mauling. You know, been in that Australia tour, they mauled. But on the whole, Six Nations in autumn weren't a dominant forward pack, in which case Smith and Farrell are operating with a hand tied behind their back. So on the one hand, you go, look, he's going to go Farrell at 10 and play quite pragmatic. Yes. But then Farrell's playing some lovely running rugby for Saracens at the moment. And then he's brought in Nick Evans. So he's brought in a guy who's made his coaching reputation at the freewheeling Harlequins, who do kick a lot, but they also play a lot of ball and they have a big running threat at number 10. So it's kind of hard to second guess it. I would expect Farrell at 10. I would expect a big 12. I would expect a playmaking 13, but I'd then expect real pace on the wings and I'd expect real dynamism in the back row. I don't know if he'll go for the big six, the big lock that Eddie was wedded to. Courtney Laws, Chessum, Isiekwe, Itoje, you often played a lock at six, or, you know, people get annoyed when you call Laws a lock, but a lock by trade. I wonder if he'll go for an out-and-out Jackler and Jack Willis, a dynamic ball carrier in someone like Ben Earl, maybe a Dom Brandt, maybe a Sam Simmons. I think he's going to look for pace and dynamism and then really try and lock up his scrum with a big type five. But it is very, very interesting. And I think as much as you think Borthwick is a certain style of coach, you saw what he did with Leicester, Saracen's influence. There are enough people saying, no, he can play other ways. And he's brought Nick Evans in to give them that other perspective.
That's what's going to be interesting, is how they balance, like, I think, the line out. And I think Borthwick's probably the only coach that is the type of coach where I feel like with his expertise at the line out, that there's a chance they don't go for that six, that lock six, because they back it. If you look when they did Curry, Underhill, Billy, none of those really without and out line out prowess, like Curry, probably the best of the three. And they found a way to make that work. And England's line out, you know, was all over New Zealand at times and top teams. So I think that's probably the question, that as long as they can find the balance in the line out, then that faster, more mobile, dynamic back row can come through. I just think England haven't quite had that expertise at line out and like absolute, like obsessive detail that like a Borthwick, a Paul O'Connell, a coach like that brings, that allows you to have that flexibility in your selection in the back row.
Yeah, such an interesting point. And that tallies into what I've been hearing about how hands-on Borthwick is going to be. Eddie kind of got hands-on during coaching sessions, but in a kind of ball under the arm, run after it. But I don't think he's offering a massive load of technical expertise in one area. And that's, maybe that's wrong, because he did have a period where he was kind of coaching the back. So maybe that's not fair. But Borthwick is going to be a hands-on coach, a tracksuit coach. He is going to be the, have the boots on, the ladder, and is going to be really driving standards, especially around the line-out. What they do with the scrum, that's obviously Cockerell's domain now. Be really interested to get your thoughts on that and whether you see them mixing things up tactically at the scrum as well as personnel. But yeah, you're right. For all of Eddie's talk of the big six in the back row, some of England's best rugby was with Curry and Underhill. And I wonder if they'll try and replicate that by playing Jack Willetts at seven and Ben Curry at six. Because really, there's not much in Ben Curry and Tom Curry. It's a sliding.
I agree.
Moment.
I've always been fascinated how Ben's not been in the mix more, considering how close he is to Tom. Like,
but remember, Ben got picked in Argentina in 17 and then got injured, and Tom played and went on to be a British Lion. Yeah. So it's a sliding doors moment, and Ben's left with like one cap he picked up in the summer. You know, I think the summer just gone. So Borthwick's looking for players who are hungry, really hungry, and are really desperate to play for England. He keeps repeating that. Passion, pride. Everyone's proud to play for their country, but I think he's looking for players who almost are showing that little bit extra. And Ben Curry might be a perfect example of that. He's had to watch his brother Tom, his career go through the roof, become a world-class star in English rugby. And now maybe it's Ben's turn with Tom injured for a few weeks.
I remember seeing them when I was coaching England under-18s and doing the scrum with those guys. And there's a Curry's, double Curry's in that class. And they're both just so impressive that one's had amazing opportunities and he's just run away with it. But I've always wondered why Ben hasn't been more in the mix when you think how robust and impressive those guys to be on a field. Having two of them always seems to make sense to me. Same
because...
with like at Sale when they played the Dupree's brothers as yeah. well. Like I'm like, sometimes it, when the old double up, of the, it works for me. And I think the question is, when is Tom back? Is he just like a hold-in for a Tom Curry until Tom comes back? Or do you think when Tom comes back, there's room for both of them in the squad?
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I wonder whether Eddie Jones's attitude was always, I can't play both because they are quite literally the same. So I need balance in a back row. It's like, however great, you know, Neil Back was or Richard Hill or Lawrence Dallaglio, you couldn't have 6, 7, 8 of the same guy. I mean, maybe Hill you could at 6 and 7, but you kind of get my point. They're the same. So they're both offering a point of difference and an engine, but does he then want someone who offers a bit more line out, a bit more jackal, a bit more carry, whatever it might be?
And it's interesting. What's he going to do with Earl Willis? What's the pecking order in Borthwick's mind of those players? And I think that's fascinating. I think the when I look at the selection, obviously Dan Cole coming back in, I think that's the right move. No Will Stewart. The depth chart at tight head starts to get very shallow. You know, Sinclair is probably still the starter in my eyes, but Dan Cole's sort of that, you know, that bedrock that you can bank on the bench, you can bring on, you can start him in a test, and you know he's gonna do a job for you. The interesting one I find is obviously where Harry Williams has got to in the pecking order and how he's never sort of been able to find his way back since 2019, where Joe Hayes has a lot of promise and he has his moments for Leicester, but he's yet to truly tick the box for me at test level to show that he belongs there. And I think same with the depth at hooker a little bit. If something happens to Cole or Sinclair or something happens to Jamie George, England, which are trying to rebuild their scrum, and we can get onto that next, are a little bit vulnerable in a few areas there. Loose head very deep. Second row is very deep, but hooker and tight head at the moment are shallower than I'm sure any coach would really want.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's a pathway thing. I don't know if that's an age grade, a premiership thing, or an Eddie Jones thing. You know, could Eddie... I mean, Eddie brought Jamie George back like 6 weeks early in the autumn because he was... even though he'd capped Nick Dolly and Jamie Blamire and McGuigan was around the setup, Jack Walker he had in camps... He only trusted the guys in Cowan Dickey and Jamie George that he inherited from Lancaster. odd one. And same with Tighthead. Sinclair, who was on, you know, went on tour with Lancaster in 14. Will Stewart, he brought through, but never like as Will Stewart, you know, scored those tries against New Zealand and looked to be having a good autumn, got injured. So maybe it was his time to kick on. It was pointed out to me by a coach a few weeks back that there's actually a lack of depth under a certain age across England at prop. You know, what age were you when you played for England? Early 20s?
22, yeah.
22. Marla was 21, 22. 21. McAvanapola. Yeah, like you guys broke through and had long, successful test careers at 21, 22. And that's not been happening, has it, over the last few years?
No.
So I don't know why that is. And that's got to be a concern for Conor O'Shea or the powers that be of the RFU who are in charge of Pathways. Where are the 19, 20, 21-year-old props that are going to do a Tyke Furlong, that are going to do a Mako, a Joe Marler, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree, mate. I just think there's been a bit of a loss in the attention to detail in, like, the Pathways. Like, if you look previously, when I come through, we had a Roundtree. Then sort of that next group of guys had a Peely before he went to Saracens overseeing. And you kind of need that, like, England scrum mentor, like, IP. Neil Hatley was there for a while, and I know he's touched guys like Will Stewart and other players on their development. But since then, I just don't think that has trickled through. And it's whether it's, you know, a harsh criticism of Proudfoot or just the RFU setup in general, like somewhere along the factory production line, England have lost that scrum IP and that sort of, you know, holding on to maybe the latest IP and what's the latest and greatest, which is what, when I played, what a whole blueprint was built on was, you know, the best IP, the best technique, the big physical gnarly pack, put a lot of attention to detail on it. But really, as long as we weren't overpowered by just enormous size, always backed us to be technically better. And you can't say that about England and their scrum right now. If anything, their scrum needs a reinventing coming into this Six Nations. And that's a task Richard Cockerell is, I know he's got his head screwed on and aware of the task at hand, but that's a big task and something that's going to be very important to the success of England going on in the Six Nations, but also long-term restoring that back into the sort of RFU England rugby DNA of we have the most elite scrummagers in the world, which hasn't been the case for a while now.
Yeah, completely. And they can't rely on, you know, I know Joe Marler's off the scene a bit at the moment, but Mako, Carl Sinclair, there needs to be a Joe Hayes or whoever it is coming through, grabbing a shirt and dominating like you see French props, South African props, yeah, Ireland props at the moment. So the fact that Dan Cole is back in is a credit to Cole for Graf. Yeah,
credit to him, man. He deserves it. And like,
yeah, it's credit, but it's an indictment also on the prop.
Oh, agree.
Tighthead prop.
Agree. Failure of the production line or the system. I agree. Yeah, I agree. It shows there's a failure in that system and that factory line. But he's also like, mate, the guy deserves 100 caps. Like, do you know what I mean? I think he's been on 97 or whatever. Like, I'm just amped for him. He deserves it. He epitomizes it. And like, I've been impressed with him. Like, to still have the longevity in his career. He's a year older than me and he's still going. It's incredible.
Wow. And how long have you been retired?
7 years now, whatever it's coming up to. So it's just excellent. Gone 7 years. So that's what I think. Good. It's like,
That's tickled me.
The year before me, and he's still playing now. Like, that guy's
your
incredible. He's one of the GOATs.
Yeah. And just one more, Corbs. What's your view on the captaincy? Because I know we touched upon it a bit earlier. Do you think a fly half, a centre, how do you feel about them leading the side? Because it's happening a lot across the Six Nations. Sexton, Dan Bigger, we'll wait to see if he's Wales captain, but him, Bigger, Farrell, Bigger, Sexton, have all captained the side. But if you look at World Cup winning sides, you look at traditional sides, you look at the focus around the set piece, the breakdown, I'm still just surprised that for the last 5-6 years, England have largely had Farrell as captain. They've had a bit of Corey, a bit of Laws, but never looked at Atoje, never looked at Jamie George. Like, would you always rather your captain in the pack, or is that just a bit of a rugby cliche that doesn't really apply anymore?
I don't think it's as applicable as it used to be. And I think now with, like, it's really not just Owen. Like, there's going to be a pack leader or someone who's in that set piece conversation with him when they're making those decisions in game time, which I'm sure Marrow and him have quite a strong relationship and good comms. It's a tough one. Like, Rob Shaw was talking about it last week on the pod that, you know, do you change the captaincy just as a new coach and a fresh voice? And it's a tough one because I think Farrell is quite a strong character. He's a leader. If he's in that team, he's assuming the reins with the captaincy ban or without, a bit like a Johnny Sexton and other guys that I've been fortunate enough to see in a playing environment. They're just leaders. They're so competitive. They want to win. You know, there's always been the question mark with Owen, like, does he have the temperament? Because sometimes he can get a little bit wound up or reactive. But I do think he's done a tremendous job at turning that down. And you don't see that in him like you maybe saw on previous years. And I think probably the biggest attribute to Owen being the England captain is I don't think there's a player in that dressing room who doesn't respect him or who wouldn't follow him to the edge of the earth. And I think once you have that and you've built that in a team and you've got that sort of credit in the bank, Steve knows him personally. Steve's seen him in that environment. You know, he's going to have gauged from the other players and coaches. Like, Farrell's almost another coach in that team as well as a player. It kind of makes sense to me. And there's not a clear and obvious definite candidate to go a different way, because you could argue Ellis Genge, you know, is captained and done well, and I think he's a vice captain in this team, but he's got to make sure he earns his place in the team at the moment. I think the scrum has question marks on it. There's some technical aspects England need to fix. I could bore everyone on the pod for about an hour going through it, but I do expect them to be much better in the Six Nations in their scrum. I think they've had a bit of a wake-up call, new eyes on the project, and they're aware of the perception, but also the technical changes they need to do to make that a strength to their game again. And then I think, like, where else do you go? Like, maybe in Itoje, but he's never captained at Sarries. He's not captained at England. Yes, he captained the under-20s, and there was always talked about as a potential leader. But he's kind of one of those guys that just goes about his business and turns up and has big moment displays anyway. I don't see a clear out-and-out person to take over Owen, and knowing his strengths, I think it's the right decision.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. I mean, yeah, it's just something I remember thinking a few years ago, 2019, when the scrum was in trouble against South Africa. Do you need someone a bit closer to the action? Eddie Jones was talking last year about Farrell and referees. Now he needs to work on that relationship. In fact, he spoke about that, you know, for a fair bit over the last couple of years, which sowed the seed with some of us that, you know, maybe Eddie was looking to move on from Farrell. Then he picked Courtney for the Australia tour. So I just felt there was enough noise and uncertainty around Farrell's captaincy for Borthwick to maybe go in a new direction. But Courtney's, what, 33, 34 now. Ellis Genge, you make the point about his place in the team with other loose heads. Yeah, I always think that Itoje was the captain in England could and should have had 5 years ago, but there's a reason why he doesn't captain his club either. And yeah, sometimes you've got to go, well, if Mark McCall backs Farrell, Eddie Jones backs Farrell, Steve Borthwick backs Farrell, that's a pretty reliable trio of rugby intellect, isn't it? That sees this guy as a great leader. I just know from speaking to people close to the team how influential Owen is, how dominant a figure he is, which is great, but can also mean that it's his way. It's Farrell's team, and I just wondered whether Borthwick would look just to freshen up the captaincy from that point of view and go with someone left field, a bit like Eddie did with Chris Robshaw and Dylan Hartley back in 2015. But he's not. He was really adamant today about Farrell's credentials, and yeah, we'll see how it pans out.
Steve has known Owen since he's a boy. Like, he's played with him as a boy. He's been in teams with him. He's then coached with him. He's coached against him. You know, like, he's going to have an insight into the man, the dynamics. Like, you can tell he's such a smart, thoughtful operator. I feel like for him to put that honour on Owen, maybe if Courtney was, like, more reliably back and robust and no question marks with potential concussion issues and other stuff, maybe he could have gone Courtney, because I do think Courtney had gained some respect and in the group as a leader there. But it also depends, you know. I think Courtney, let's just hope he can stay fit and play, because, you know, he's been through the ringer recently, and I think everyone's just hoping that. And if anything, it takes a bit of pressure off him, because I kind of remember, your Dylan Hartleys, you know, just fighting to get fit. You've got that moniker of captaincy. It puts more pressure, burden on you to push through injuries, to maybe ignore warning signs. There's a lot, you know, I feel like removing that pressure might be what's best for Courtney, and just hoping that he is actually fit and on the field for the Six Nations, because England have missed him, and wherever you play him, second row or back row, he's a valuable piece of that puzzle.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. Laws has had so long out. He had his concussion issues, then I think it was a hip or glute issue. And at his age, he probably just, you know, needs to concentrate on his own game. Yeah, and look, the Toje thing, I wondered if it might be a case of Borthwick coming in and going, look, obviously this guy is got 5 years of captaincy ahead of him, but he's not gone for that. And so I think Itoje will just go down as one of those guys who will never captain England. We'll all wonder what might have been. But, you know, people who have played with him have said, look, he's a great player, a great guy, but not everyone is necessarily captaincy material. And yeah, there's a lot of people who spend a lot more time in camp who can give a better idea of that. But I just think it's interesting that he's stuck with Farrell. He's been captain for 5 years. There's scrutiny on Farrell's tackle technique. There's scrutiny on who plays in the midfield, how he dovetails with Smith. Does he play 10? Does he play 12? There's scrutiny on him with referees. So I think it's a lot for Farrell to take on. But as Borthwick said today, if anyone can revel in that responsibility, it is Owen Farrell.
Yeah, and that's fair, mate. He's obviously under the heat with the tackle technique, which I understand, because he's had a number of incidents. But you actually look on paper of his actual red cards, or, you know, what his actual, you know, like, it's not as big an issue as it is in the media. And then also it's a bit dicey with the bit of the heat going around about them being clever with his ban to make sure he's available to play. Then you give him the captaincy. It all kind of like does add fuel to that, you know, fire of people saying, oh, something stinks over here. It was all, you know, pre-arranged, or, you know, not independently adjudicated with this was all in mind or whatever, which I don't think is fully the case. I think all teams bend the rules. Like, as we're talking about the Farrell, like, do I think it's the best look? No. But how many other examples of other teams doing it are there? The precedent's been set. Is it fair to cry foul now when this one, high profile? For me, no, I'm okay with it. And I don't blame England for gaming the system to get their best players back on the field. Like, I'm already very torn with the length of bans for, like, more accidental high shots than, like, savagery. Do you know what I mean? Like, then savagery. It is a tough one for me because, man, some of those things are just split seconds. And, like, when you start getting over 6 week ban, like, you're like, oh man, like, I'm the biggest advocate of head injury and the importance of concussion. My track record of taking this serious goes back further than nearly every other player out there. Like, you can look at it's on paper and document, like, 2013-14 talking about it and how it needs to be an issue and HIA and everything. Like, I'm not weak on headshots, but I think there has to be some adaption in the game for that understanding of those accidental last split second dips. And I'm not as outraged as if he'd punched someone, gouged someone, done something a bit more cynical, and then got a red card and then been allowed to come back sooner as such, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think the fact is Farrell would have only got 2 weeks if he didn't have a red card on his record. So that's his problem. Like, yeah. Some people go, oh, he's managed to get away with only 3 weeks, or his record's not come into it. That's not true. His record's come into it because it went 6 weeks down to four rather than down to three. And then it was gone 6-4 and then to three with the tackle score. Otherwise, it would have gone 6-3-2. And 2 weeks, I think, is maybe a lot of bans for kind of the marginal red cards. No great malice, but a bit of carelessness, recklessness, mistiming, going in too high, a bit too upright. All the markers, 2 weeks, I think, is roundabout right. If there's no great harm caused to the player in terms of they don't have to have an HIA or they don't have any latent delayed concussions or whatever, or don't go off. But Farrell went to three because of his red card in 2020. So his record has cost him a bit here, even though he's not got a load of red and yellow cards on his sheet. So... I don't like the way the RFU, who often can talk a big game over values, integrity and respect, are clearly gaming the system here. It's not even a debate that they're gaming the system, because they are saying we are releasing our captain for a match when he's not available, it's farcical.
It's weird. And how do you feel about the tackle school? Like, is that a normal thing? Does that the one thing I wasn't sure if that is common practice across these bands, or is that something that's just kind of been brought in this instance?
It's been brought in a lot in the last 6 months or so. I can't remember exactly when tackle school became a thing, but it's happening a lot. You are eligible for tackle school if you've not had tackle school came in 2021 kind of time. Farrell's Charlie Atkinson Red was in 2020, so he's eligible for tackle school. And yeah, it feels a bit window dressing, a bit of box ticking, but equally Borthwick was talking today about the modules Kevin Sinfield's been involved in with tackle school, and it's something, isn't it? It's something to try and change behaviours. We often lament how behaviour's not changing. This is an attempt to change it. I've got no problem with the ban. 3 weeks seems about right. Anything more would have been unfair. It wasn't a horrible tackle.
Yeah, that's my point. It's like,
yeah, and yeah, you're right. And I completely
agree.
It wasn't
the worst thing in the world.
I just find it ironic that the RFU would stand up and talk such a passionate game about brain injuries, yet this is an active attempt to make a ban not apply for the games it could and should. Yeah. And there is an argument to go, you're talking rubbish. There are three games between now and the Six Nations, or come last week, three Saracens games, he's banned for three. But under the PGA, he isn't released for that game. Under the PGA, he doesn't play in that game. And it's meant to be under the RFU regulations. Meaningful matches, they're scheduled to play.
Didn't Ireland do that with Kian Healy? And like Bath like had Prem Cup games and a Prem game within 2 days of each other, and players are allowed to count both.
Yeah,
it's
all nonsense because it's all in this, like, there are two sides to all of this attempt to change the perception of the game. There's the objective side that impartial people look at, which is the bigger picture. So we're looking at a bigger picture, 3 week ban, it should apply. And then you've got the subjectivity that we saw with coaches over the weekend complaining about decisions that are, under the letter of the law, correct. And they're going, they're wrong. You're like, no, that's the law. You've got to abide by the laws. Like, I may think it's wrong that the road I live on is now 20 miles an hour, but I can't go 30 and then go, oh, well, it's stupid, it's 20. It's 20, you know? So if you have a coach who's got a player that's got a red card, unfortunately, whether you like it or not, that is the way the game is being officiated. So both the London Irish Reds, or the London Irish Red, there was a big complaint from their coaches. But you think you're coming at that from a passionate, subjective point of view. And that's really hard in the heat at the moment. But at some point, coaches and players need to take a step back and go, I need to look at this in the round, holistically. And if you're the RFU, it sends a much better message in the round to go, Owen got three games, he will miss three games, when actually he's only missing two. However, they've done it. I don't think it's a great look. They're not the first union to do it. I think it's hard on Borthwick to sort of put him in the middle of it. But yeah, I think that it's a farcical situation to pretend that Farrell would have been released for that national game.
I agree. Bro, you know they know it's silly, but they're just doing it because it's suiting them and it's precedented in before. But I agree with what you're saying. And, you know, I agree. Chris, I think that's where we'll probably end this one. I think we covered a lot of ground there. Thank you so much for your insight. Thanks for your time. And I do love just chatting with you and going back and forth. And yeah, I appreciate it as always, mate. You're a good asset to this pod. And we appreciate
Mate, anytime. Great to hear. Yeah. And Happy New Year to you and all the Scrum Down listeners. I'm sure we'll pick this up during the Six Nations and beyond.
And that is a wrap on this week's Scrum Down. Thanks again to Chris for coming on. Lots to talk through there. We really appreciate it. This Eddie Jones news, I feel that's only just getting started. So I don't think it's the last time we'll be talking about this. I'm sure there'll be plenty more developments with England running into the Six Nations. And we're going to turn our attention in upcoming weeks to some of the other countries in the Six Nations as well, as it is upon us here on NBC, kicking off live on Peacock TV, replaying on linear TV as well. So lots of Six Nations coverage to come from us. But for everyone listening, for everyone watching on NBC Sports YouTube, we really appreciate the support. Keep liking, sharing, favoriting, commenting, retweeting, spreading the word of the pod. Lots more to come. And we really appreciate all our loyal Scrum Down listeners here on the pod. And that's a wrap from me. See you again next week.